It's a gay spirit singing in our hearts, leading us through these troubled times. It's a gay spirit moving round this land, calling us to a time of open love.
This is The Gay Life on KSAN, and I'm Randy Alfred. Lammas, a witch's Sabbath, much like Halloween, falls in the middle of this week, and we're bringing you two of the city's most noted gay witches on this show. Later in the show, we'll talk to Batya Podos, who delivered the invocations at Gay Freedom Day both last year and this. But we'll start with Arthur Evans, author of Witchcraft and the Gay Counterculture. Good morning, Arthur.
Hi, Randy.
Arthur, I first saw you on the Dick Cavett Show way back in 1970, I think, and that was about 5 years before I met you, and you were already appearing as a spokesperson for gay liberation less than a year after Stonewall. How far back does your involvement in the gay liberation movement go?
Well, I got involved in the movement about a year before that, starting in 1969 in July. That was a month after the Stonewall riots, which happened in the last week in June.
Where were you when you heard about Stonewall?
I was a graduate student at Columbia, pretty much oblivious to everything that's important in the world. And I remember picking up a copy of the New York Times and reading a little filler article that there had been a homosexual riot in Greenwich Village the day before. And I made a note of it in my mind, but it really didn't shake me to my foundations, as I knew it later would. But a few weeks later, I was walking down Christopher Street with my lover at the time, also named Arthur, and a young man came up and gave us a leaflet and told us about a meeting of a new group called the Gay Liberation Front. And it sounded very exciting to me and Arthur, so we thought we would go and check it out.
Is that Arthur Bell?
Yes, that's Arthur Bell.
Village Voice columnist who has dedicated his latest book to you.
Yes, and now we're on good terms. There was a long hiatus in that relationship, however. But as a result of getting that leaflet, I've always believed in the value of leafleting, because the leaflet that that young man gave me completely changed my life in every respect. And whoever he was, I'm very grateful to him and his leaflet.
Chances are he's here in San Francisco now.
There are a lot of us ex-New Yorkers here, yes. Who knows, I may have run into him already.
Well, what happened at the first meeting that so changed your life?
I went to the first meeting, and I was excited to see gay women and men together and talking about social change and feeling very assertive and affirmative about their identity, not having really any questions of guilt or doubt about themselves. All of that was laid behind. There was just no question. They started from the assumption that we are whole people and that we are being oppressed and we have to resist. And that sensibility, which was taken for granted, was very exciting to me.
Now, that resistance took some very imaginative and creative forms in ways for which you certainly have a reputation, or I should say a legendary presence in the gay movement. You were arrested 5 times?
Yes, I was. What? That was mostly through the Gay Activists Alliance, which was another organization that I got involved in after the Gay Liberation Front.
What happened to GLF?
GLF continued for quite a while alongside of GAA, and both organizations did a lot of good work for gay people, but I was more into immediate street actions directed around immediate gay issues. GLF was into many different issues at the time and tended to become theoretical rather than action-oriented, although that's an oversimplification.
So those were the days of the Zaps.
Oh, yes. We had some wonderful Zaps in those days.
What'd you do?
Well, we had an expression to the effect that a Zap a day keeps the shrink away. And what we meant by that was that through direct action on the streets, we would get a sense of who we are and of who the enemy was. And we would affirm and support each other, and we wouldn't need straight ideologies to kind of make us come to terms with ourselves. And we did all sorts of outrageous things. One that I'm very fond of telling about involves the city clerk of New York, and a man by the name of Herman Katz. We had introduced legislation into the city council that would outlaw job discrimination against lesbians and gay men. That legislation still has not passed. It was the first city in the United States it was introduced into. And we got a lot of resistance, as we expected. But a strange type of resistance came from Herman Katz, the city clerk, whose job was to issue marriage licenses. And he gave a statement to the New York Post, totally unsolicited, saying that he was appalled by this legislation and making very rude remarks about gay people. So we thought, since he was kind of in the heart of institutionalized compulsive heterosexuality, that is, issuing licenses, we thought we would go down there and raise his consciousness, which we did. We all gathered outside of City Hall, his office near City Hall, and we got this huge wedding cake with two men on the top and two women on the top, and a coffee urn and donuts, and we just took the elevator up all of a sudden and stormed into the office. We stormed into the office and started handing out donuts to the people who worked there and coffee. And Pete Fisher was along, the author of The Gay Mystique and co-author of Special Teachers, Special Boys, and he was playing his guitar. And we took over the telephones. We started answering the telephones. And I picked up the phone and said, they would say, "Hello, is this the city clerk?" And I would say, "Yes, but there's been a homosexual takeover. And today we're only issuing marriage licenses to lesbians and gay men." And the people who called in got off on it. They knew something was going on, and the employees got off on it, but the bosses got a little uptight, and they called the police. The police came in. And the police threatened to arrest us, but we said, "How can you arrest us for having a party?" And finally they didn't arrest us. We left. But as a result of that, we got good publicity. Word got around that gay people were organizing, and they were doing it in a witty and dramatic way. And the thrust of that was that it grabbed closeted gay people emotionally. Before, closeted gay people had gotten all this, well, they had gotten some ideology from the gay liberation movement. But when they read about things like that in the paper, they got emotionally involved in it. Either they liked it very much or they disliked it very much. And that was good, even if they disliked it very much, because we tended to break through their shells of rationalization.
More so than counter-rationalization or ideological right. manifestos
right.
would do.
Right. And that's why street theater, that's why I believe in street theater, because street theater has a political content, but it reaches people's hearts as well, and that's very important. In
this was 69-70 when this kind of theatrical politics was still very right. untried and
oh, yes, right.
people weren't aware of it. And yet already there I see the beginnings of magical consciousness working their way into the politics, because isn't the whole connection of gay men to the theater one that's
oh, yes.
deeply rooted in...
Yes, well, I believe that the connection between gay men and the theater goes back to the ritual worship of the god Dionysus in Greek culture. But you're right. Street theater, where a group of people get together and perform a ritual that has highly charged emotional connotations for the community and which serves to reach into people's deeper inner levels, is certainly a magical act.
I'd like to hear about at least one more zap that you did from.
Well, we did many zaps around.
Did you do the one on the shrinks?
No. Well, we did some of them, but I know the one you're referring about. But we did a lot around John Lindsay at the time. We had some great zaps around John Lindsay. He was the mayor of New York, and he was passing himself off as this great white liberal. But in fact, he had kind of very conservative and unliberated concepts around the issue of homosexuality. And all we wanted from good Mayor Lindsay was to support the gay rights bill that we had introduced, just to say something that he supported it. But he refused. He wouldn't even meet with us. So we decided to break down the barrier between politics and his personal life and to hold him personally responsible for these political decisions. And we did that by disrupting his personal life. He was very fond of going to the theater. And his wife had organized some big social event at a theater opening on Broadway. I forget the name of it anymore. And we knew he would be there, so we went into the theater in theater crowd drag, and we held drinks in our hand, and we waited until he and his wife came in. And as soon as they came to the door, we surrounded them and started shouting, "Speak out for gay rights and end police harassment," because it was police harassment at the time. And his wife was absolutely incensed, Mary Lindsay. She was infuriated because we had disrupted her social event. And she charged into the crowd, and she came up to me, and she started punching me in the chest. And she was just going crazy. She was pounding me in the chest. And John grabbed her by the hand. That's the mayor. Grabbed her by the hand and took her inside and chewed her ear off for doing that. So we were delighted because we caused a family quarrel between the Lindsays over an issue of gay liberation. And as a result of tactics like that, he came around. He got tired of having his life disrupted, and he said, okay, I'll meet with you. And eventually then he supported the bill. But it took a lot of pushing.
When did you leave New York and why? This is a question I've asked people who are leaving San Francisco to return to New York, but let me ask it this way.
I left New York in April of 72. And the reason I did was that I felt like I was dying in that city. It was getting harder and harder to be poor, just to survive and be poor. It was getting difficult to breathe. And I felt that there was a whole area of my personality which craved at least some minimal contact with nature and with an environment outside of heavy-duty anonymous city streets. And it was hard for me to do that in New York. I still love New York, and New York has done great things for me, but I would never go back there and live again.
So you came to San Francisco where there's more nature, or did you try living in the country for a while?
My lover and I at the time, another man by the name of Jacob Schrader, we thought that we would move out into the country and start a whole new lifestyle with only $1,500. So we left New York, and we went land hunting. I was very naive in those days. I had a lot to learn about the world outside of New York. We went land hunting, and first we went to Washington State. First we went to California, actually, and we found what land prices are here in, like, Marin County. That was a joke. So we rode off California, and we went to Washington State. And we couldn't find any land there. And we went to Alaska. And there was land, but the mosquitoes didn't want us. We had some terrible mosquito stories. So eventually we ended up in Seattle, and we lived there for a few years. And then we moved to San Francisco.
And in San Francisco, you got immediately involved in some movement activities, it seems. I remember meeting you around 75.
Well, I was involved with Bay Area Gay Liberation, BAGL, that was here. They turned up a lot of energy in San Francisco.
Did you feel that there was anything in the kind of Zap-like imaginative creative politics that was done out here? Can you think of anything?
San Francisco has never been into that. One thing we did was when the Board of Education was a little sluggish about supporting the right of gay teachers in San Francisco, we went down there and gave them a pep talk. There was a huge number of gay people. I remember Harvey Milk was there. And when the board came in, we shouted and sang songs and clapped our hands and kind of danced around. And there was a confrontation over that. They came around with us. In fact, they had decided to do it before we had the demonstration. And we also did a zap against Mondale, Vice President Mondale, in the Hall of Flowers, this was as a result of the energy that Anita Bryant was stirring up. The President of the United States and the Vice President of the United States were saying nothing about the rights of lesbians and gay men, although they kept flapping their jaw about human rights everywhere. So Walter Mondale had the nerve to come to San Francisco with one of the largest gay communities in the world and think that he could get away without addressing the issue of gay rights while our lives and rights were at stake because of Anita Bryant.
That was in June of 77 then.
Right. And he came here and he spoke at the Hall of Flowers. And a number of us infiltrated inside, and after he had made a few ridiculous plastic remarks, started shouting, why don't you support gay rights? And he was totally nonplussed. I was amazed. Here's a professional politician, and all he could think to do was to stand back and look shocked. He had no wit, no humor, no sense of drama, no theater, no camp at all. Totally campless. And poor George Moscone had to come to his rescue and ran over and said, please be good and let the vice president speak, which we finally did. But I think that he remembers that encounter in San Francisco. And as a result, I hope that a little bit of word got back to the White House that gay people in San Francisco are angry.
More recently, you've undertaken some verbal guerrilla warfare or guerrilla action on the streets, as it were, in the form of some highly imaginative street posters critical of gay life in San Francisco.
Yes, I like to write under the name of the Red Queen, and I've been putting up leaflets attacking conformity and commercialization in the gay male ghettos of San Francisco. I've done that out of a sense of desperation because I feel that I and many other people have devoted much energy to creating a gay liberation movement, and in San Francisco it's in danger being swallowed up by what I call clone capitalism. And this is essentially privileged white gay men who want to be assimilated into the establishment and make as much money for themselves as they can. And I believe that they control many of the bars and the gay media and a lot of the cultural attitudes, and that they are taking gay liberation or gay people in a disastrous direction, a direction which denies the spirit, which denies all the magic and beauty of being gay, and which would settle for a pale imitation of heterosexual capitalism. And I resist that and want no part of it. And so what I've been doing in my leaflets is trying to point out the absurdity of a lot of this mentality and doing it through humor so that people can laugh at it, but at the same time get a political point out of it.
Well, what kind of reaction have those leaflets had?
They've had many reactions. I remember when I first put up my first leaflet, which said, "Afraid you're not butch enough," and ridiculed the attempt of gay men to make themselves butcher and butcher, this attempt to become butchers. I was walking down Haight Street, and there was this man who was very butch in a tank top, and he was reading with a very grim expression on his face. And I just stood at the corner and watched him. He didn't know I wrote it, and he was standing there reading it. And all of a sudden, his face flushed red. I don't know which line, particular line he read, and he reached up and he grabbed it and ripped it down and kind of shredded off and walked off in a huff. Frankly, I was surprised he could read, but but he was able to read, and he didn't like it and had a negative reaction. Other reactions have been positive. There have been people who said, "I've felt a lot of these frustrations myself, and I'm glad to see that it's becoming a public issue that we can talk about."
Isn't, in fact, the clone microculture of the gay subculture really only a fraction of it?
It is, but it's a very powerful fraction because it's most gay men, I believe.
Are you staring at my new haircut? We're all influenced by it.
Yes, we're all influenced by it, but it's plugged into money and it's plugged into media. The media support it, and the people who control the bars and the baths support it. They have a hold on our fantasy. That's the insidious part. They have a hold on our fantasy, and that's what upsets me. That fantasy is affects all of us.
Well, we've been talking to you as Arthur Evans, the politician, but you're also Arthur Evans, the historical scholar, who has dredged up from the hidden murk of the gay past a lot of fascinating connections in the relationship of gay men and lesbians to witchcraft in the past. And your book on witchcraft and the gay counterculture, in fact, grows out of a whole series of articles you did in Out magazine and then Fag Rag, a series of lectures you did in San Francisco. Where does the politics and the magic connect before we get into discussing the magic itself, using this as a bridge?
Well, I'll try to give you a succinct answer to that. I believe that lesbians and gay men have been part of an ancient historical tradition in the West and in many other areas of the world, where they played an honored and important role in religion, particularly in societies that were close to nature and respected it. And I believe that that has been suppressed by the rise of what I call patriarchal industrialism. And as a consequence of the rise of industrialism, gay history has been suppressed, women have been suppressed, sexuality has been compartmentalized, and that we, all of us, straight and gay, have lost the magic sense of life. And what I've tried to do in my book is point out how this series of disasters occurred and what we can do about it and who's responsible.
Who do you think is responsible?
The dominant institutions of Western culture are responsible for it. The large corporations, the church, the military, the psychiatric establishment, the universities. It's not as if they sat down and had a conspiracy. What has happened is that they have each fed on each other's self-interest and built up a common sense of power and wealth. And on the basis of that, they have devastated the environment and devastated our personal lives. And I think we need a total restructuring of society, not just a new administration in Washington or a new political party in power, or even a new ideology. But we need new ways of producing commodities, new ways of having sex, new ways of waging warfare, new ways of celebrating magic, new ways of making music.
So that you're not following by any means a classical Marxist line.
No, I've learned a lot from Marx, but Marxism has failed gay people. And we need to build on Marx and take out of it what we can and go on to develop new perspectives, and that's what I've tried to do.
So it's more of a mystical socialism than a material socialism.
It is, if you understand mysticism in a certain way. To me, mysticism is not an escape from reality or an escape from materialism, but mysticism for me is realizing the spiritual possibilities of matter, realizing that having sex is a spiritual activity, that masturbation is a spiritual activity, that sitting down with people and singing is a spiritual activity, that the way you keep your house is a spiritual activity. So it's a mysticism, but it's not a mysticism in the sense that that word is usually understood.
It's not detached from everyday life.
No,
then.
It's very much a part of it.
We'll talk more about mysticism and reintroducing it on this Gay Life show on KSAN, which happens the weekend before the eve of August, a Witch's Sabbath, when Arthur Evans, author of Witchcraft and the Gay Counterculture, is joined by lesbian witch Batya Podos, who will be here in just a moment.
Now, as a public service, KSAN San Francisco brings you The Sea Scale.
And we've just been joined by Batya Podos, a lecturer in the Women's Studies program at San Francisco State University. Good morning, Batya.
Good morning.
And Batya and Arthur, who have known of each other, have just met for the first time.
It's a nice experience.
It really is. We've talked on the phone.
Yes, we have. I remember that phone call. It was a very encouraging one.
I had to call you up and cheer you on.
Yes, I was having a depressing period, but Batya told me that she got good energy from the book, and I was glad to hear that.
Very much so.
You were using it in your courses at
No,
State?
I will be in the fall. I just discovered it a few months ago.
And what course will you be teaching?
Women's Myth and Ritual.
Women's Myth and Ritual.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in the Women's Studies
program? That's in the Women's Studies program at State.
Has that course been offered before, or is it?
This is the third time it's offered.
What kind of reaction does it get from students, and what from fellow faculty?
Great reaction from students. I've got about 35 students every time, which is a nice, large class. Faculty in the Women's Studies program like it a lot. Other faculty don't pay me much attention.
San Francisco State, 3 years ago, Arthur and I were part of a ritual exorcism of the demons of academic stiffness and a call to real learning, right? In,
yes, I remember that. On the now that you mention it,
grassy green in front of the student center building.
Oh, I don't remember that. I might not have been there then.
The gay organization there was having a conference, and it had a very heavy professional academic thrust to it. And we tried to remind them in a gentle way that there are other realities to deal with. We had a lot of fun.
After the last of the formal panels was over, we danced and formed a chain or a snake-like dance through the entire student union building, going up and down stairs and around and about, shouting, "Witches and fairies and faggots unite."
Oh, and wonderful.
It was a tremendous experience. It was a different place to be doing magic. That's absolutely certain. So how does Arthur's book, a book by a man that's predominantly about gay male involvement, although not exclusively, how does that fit into a women's studies course?
The course that I teach is about the goddess in her many and various aspects, and his book talks a lot about what I've been talking about for years in terms of pre-Christian cultures and the worship of female deity and what happened when the church came in. And his book is one of the first that I found that really talks about class issues and things that I've been mentioning for a long time. And I never found it written anyplace until I picked up Arthur's book.
What did happen when the church came in?
Killed a lot of people in the name of Jesus Christ. Put down the peasantry. Established a very strong political and economic unit.
Weren't the Romans trying to do that on their own, with their own religions, even before the Catholic Church built on the empire?
But the Romans were pantheistic, and they celebrated and worshipped a lot of different goddesses and gods. And the Christian Church, taking its base from Judaism, as it did, was very male-identified and didn't leave a whole lot of space for women and women's energy and women's mysteries.
Is that the way you see it too, Arthur?
Yes, I do. I believe that the transition to patriarchal violence existed before the rise of Christianity, but I think that Bacci is certainly right. Christianity came in and took the worst aspects of certain trends that were developing in the classical world and emphasized them to catastrophic proportions, with the result that a great many people suffered very many terrible things.
I was just found myself for a moment just wishing we were on television so that you could see the loving looks that Arthur and Bacci, who know each other by reputation and by phone call and are sitting together in the same room for the first time, are just looking at each other, admiring each other, and enjoying being in the same room. And it just doesn't come through without the camera.
Well, I'm certainly feeling it.
Yeah, it's very special.
I asked Arthur this question shortly before you arrived, Bacci. What can we do to reintroduce that sense of magic?
I think the very first thing we can do is to remember that we live on the earth, and the earth is alive and sustains us. And we need to sustain the earth if we intend to remain alive. That, to me, is a focus of my magic, certainly, and a focus of what the craft is all about for me as a religion. And I think that's the thing that is seriously missing from our dualistic society. You know, everything's very separated. We've got the intellect. We've got the emotion. We don't live organically. We don't live as a whole unit in the universe and take responsibility for the fact that we are here on the earth in the universe. For me, that's the base of magic and the base of reintegrating it into the society at all would be just that recognition that we have a responsibility to the forces and the energies around us. We have a responsibility to the earth, and we are one with it. And we live with it and get sustenance from it and give back to it.
So that this is part of a shift from paternal sky religions to more maternal earth religions?
I don't really like to use those words. I don't see that why we have to differentiate between sky and earth. It's all an organic unit. Everything exists as energy. Everything exists. Surely we can take the best part of all of that and incorporate that into ourselves in some way without having to label it male or female, without having to label it maternal, paternal, but just accept it as it is.
Isn't there a danger in this kind of the everything exists notion of accepting everything as it exists and losing the edge of wanting to introduce social change and rectify injustices?
I'm not speaking about social change right now. When I'm talking in terms of everything as it exists, accepting that, there's a patriarchal mindset of controlling everything that I think is one of the reasons that magic doesn't exist today, except in small occult enclaves. And it's some of that control I would like to see disappear. It's some of that control I would like to see given up. It's that control, I think, which causes a lot of the political problems we have. I realize I'm talking on a really metaphysical level right now, but it's that kind of linearity that's limiting, one of the things that's limiting us.
Arthur, you look very thoughtful and reflective. What's on your mind?
I feel that, answering your question from a different angle, I feel that human beings must always intervene in nature because we are part of nature. But we have the choice of whether we're going to intervene with reverence and respect and in a creative way, or whether we're going to intervene in a very callous, exploitive, and manipulative way. We have the same choice in our social relations. And the thing that upsets me is that the choices that are being made these days, both with respect to nature and with respect to societies, are not being made out of reverence or respect or any feeling of love. They're being made out of self-interest and domination by people who I never put in power and by institutions which never consult my needs.
Absolutely.
You have to return shortly to your auto repair, VW repair shop called The Buggery, which, of course, is interesting as a pun in and of itself, but it goes further back than that into your studies. You know something about the origin of the word buggery that I'd like you to share.
Let me tell you something about buggery.
Share with the listeners.
Buggery does not just refer to a certain type of sexual activity. Buggery has a very ancient and honorable tradition behind it, going back to a group of heretics that existed in the early Middle Ages. The heresy originally came out of Bulgaria, and the word bugger was the old word for Bulgarian. And the people called buggers were people who combined certain elements of Christianity and certain elements of the old peasant religions, and they tried to incorporate spirituality into sexuality. And as a result, the church labeled them as heretics and destroyed them. And they are the origin of the modern word bugger. So that word is both sexual and magical, both sexual and religious. And it's a very honorable and important word. So when my friend Naftali and I opened our Volkswagen repair business, we could think of nothing better than to call it the buggery.
And I want to remind listeners that witchcraft and the gay counterculture is an excellent summary and explanation of Arthur's entire historical thesis on the relationship of gay culture to what you just called the old religion, that it's the work of years and years of research and involvement by a lot of Arthur's friends. It's published by Fag Rag Press. Where can people find Witchcraft and the Gay Counterculture?
They can find it at bookstores, in the Haight, in the Castro area, and particularly at Modern Times at the corner of 17th and Sanchez, which is my favorite bookstore in the whole city. One of my favorite bookstores.
Okay. Thank you for joining us this morning on The Gay Life, Arthur Evans. Batya, in both 1978 and 1979, you opened the Gay Freedom Day festivities at Civic Center with an invocation to the goddess. What do you think is the place of goddess-oriented religion and witchcraft, if you will, in the gay movement?
I think that goddess-oriented religion is absolutely essential. I think particularly in the gay movement, until we can stop defining ourselves, all of us, women and men, by male terms, we're in a lot of trouble. And one of the ways to redefine ourselves is to redefine our structures. I think that we're structured not just, I have my own peculiar idea about the way things work. And one of the ideas that I have is that our society is based on a set of morals. And we make laws according to those morals, and things run according to those morals. And at this point in time, those morals are the morals of a Judeo-Christian patriarchal culture, at least in the United States, in the Western world. And until we look at those deep-seated belief systems within ourselves and change those, we're not going to be able to change the actual structure of what's going on. That's my particular and some people would say peculiar way of looking at political situations. I think the goddess is essential because she is the neglected female and feminine aspect of the universe. She is all that that has been really negated over the last 2,500 years. That we can only begin to understand, and that we've got to reincorporate into ourselves. If we want to redefine ourselves in a way that's apart from what we've got now, and if we want to understand that there are other kinds of alternatives for social structure and for relating to each other and for relationships and for defining ourselves.
Could you be more precise about what you believe those alternatives are? If this were your wrap-up, the last lecture of your course, and having gone through all of the material, and you wanted to lay out your own personal vision for your students.
I think my own personal vision would include what for me are laws of the craft. And the first is that you are responsible. That what you do does come back to you. That what you do, that you make decisions about what you do. And you act on those decisions, and what energy you put out to whatever decisions you make does affect things. It does affect events, does affect relationships, does affect your being in the world in a certain way. And the other is harm none and do what thou wilt. Harm none is very important.
So politically, that translates into commitment to nonviolence?
Politically, that translates into commitment to other human beings as human beings, and to see that essence of every single person, where we are alike, so that we can draw upon the things that keep us together rather than separate ourselves from each other, and which causes, not just among the gay community, but among all alternative political movements, such schisms that we can accomplish nothing. In the gay community alone, there are, 20, 30 factions of people who are not coming together, who are not looking at what makes us the same, why we are alike. Let's not talk about what divides us. Let's look at ourselves as human beings and come together on the points that we have in common. I think that on a real humanistic level, what happens is that people look at us and they say, I don't understand you and I'm afraid of you, and so I'm going to try to dissolve you from my world in some way. And if we can somehow connect, let's say with people who aren't gay, on that level where we are human, so that they are no longer afraid of us, then they will possibly not try to eradicate us in the same way.
Now, there are gay Christians inside the gay movement who feel that connecting gay people with paganism and opening with a pagan invocation 2 years in a row is catering to the worst fears of middle America. Is there any danger of political backlash in that as witches and pagans come out of the closet?
Backlash. Of course. It's happening. It's happening now. It will get worse. As more witches and pagans say, yes, I'm a witch, yes, I'm a pagan, yes, I believe in the great goddess, or I believe in the horned god, or I worship nature deities, or I have an other kind of spiritual reality than the accepted, it is dangerous. There is a backlash. There will be. As far as gay Christians, as far as anyone who has any other religious beliefs, harm none and do what thou wilt. You are free to believe what you will. I am free to believe what I will. We are all ultimately, those of us who deal with the spirit, talking about the same things. It's how we define them that makes the difference and makes us feel that we're not talking about the same things.
So you think that it's not different spirituality, but different vocabularies for the same spirituality?
I think ultimately, again, I find myself really talking on a metaphysical level. Ultimately, if you're talking about spirit, no matter what you call spirit, if you're really involved with discovering what that is for yourself and discovering how to operate with that in the universe, discovering how to operate with that on a daily level, you're probably talking about the same thing. It's when you start defining how the best way is to do that, or what particularly is the kind of spirit that you're worshiping is apart from the kind of spirit somebody else is worshiping, that we start getting into trouble. And it's when we say, well, my spirit is the only spirit to worship, and therefore it's the best one, and if you don't worship in the way, or if you don't live the kind of spirit that I want to live, then you haven't got a chance, or then I'm going to be after you, or then I'm going to, you know, my way is the only way. That's when we start getting into trouble.
When did you first become involved in the craft?
Formally, about 4 years ago.
And I deduce from that that informally it was somewhat before that.
Informally, I think very much so when I was very young and growing up. And then not at all when I was an adolescent into a young adult. And then again, there was a period of time where I was not doing any of that stuff. I think it had to do with growing up. When I was a child, I was doing magic all the time.
Has it always been associated with feminist consciousness in your own life?
Definitely. In my own life, the time that I started seriously studying the craft, I was also in the process of raising my consciousness and coming out as a feminist. I was also in the process of raising my consciousness and coming out as a lesbian. I was for the first time in my life, very much involved with very hard material political activity. I was very much involved with helping to put the Women's Studies program together at State and be out there in a very large way politically for me. It was all interconnected. I can't say that had all that not been going on, you know, this wouldn't have happened.
Do you get flack from politicians who are into a specifically material analysis?
Oh, yes.
What do you tell them?
Well,
and I've heard this many times myself, that all of the spiritual stuff is just superstructure that lays on top of the economic reality.
I don't deny the economic reality or that analysis at all. It's very viable. I say that you have to look deeper than the economic reality, that you have to go to what people believe, and you have to change them there as well as changing the economic reality, because if you don't change them there, changing the economic reality won't mean anything.
We're talking to Batya Podos here on The Gay Life on KSAN. Batya teaches women's studies at San Francisco State, a course in Women's Spirituality. What is the exact title of it?
Women's Myth and Ritual.
Women's Myth and Ritual. Now, associated with teaching Women's Myth and Ritual, you've also been involved with drama for quite a while, and I understand that you've written your own play.
Yes.
What is it?
It is Ariadne. It's about Ariadne, of course, who is the high priestess of ancient Minoan Crete, and it's about the Greek takeover of the Minoan peoples. The Minoans controlled the Mediterranean for anywhere from 1500 to 3000 years. And about 1500 BC, there was a cataclysm and there were invaders. And the Minoan culture was destroyed. The Minoan culture was a matrifocal culture.
Which means mother-centered?
Which means focused on the female. Mm-hmm. And they had a trading culture with Egypt and with Asia and with Africa and with the entire Mediterranean. They did not have any fortresses. They did not have any army. And from what we know, they did not have any wars. They were a peaceful people. Their society was based on the worship of the mother snake goddess and her bull consort, who was her lover or her prince. And the Greeks came in. And that culture was destroyed. And Ariadne is the focal point, the myth of Theseus and Ariadne. The story always goes that she fell in love with him and she helped him destroy her own culture. She helped him kill the Minotaur. She helped him leave Crete. I say that she didn't help him. And that's where I differ from the traditional myth.
And your script is complete and you're planning a production?
My script is complete. We're in rehearsal. We open October 26th at Studio Aramis, which is in Project Arto at 17th and Alabama.
I hope you'll remind us again in the fall, and we'll remind people listening to The Gay Life about that that production. I'm looking forward to it myself.
I will definitely. I'm very proud of it.
And this is the first play that you've written yourself, but you've been involved in drama for quite a while.
I was going to be an actress at one time. That was what I did for about 10 years, and then stopped, and have been back as a director for the last almost four.
Do you think that that gives you any sense of the dramatic aspects of ritual magic, as well as when you were back there, did you have a sense of the ritual sense of even what is conventional Western stage drama?
Oh, it's amazingly the same. When I was studying acting, I was studying Stanislavski. And when I was studying magic, I found that the same exercises that I'd been doing all these years as an actor were the same stuff that I was doing as a witch. It's learning how to transmute energy. And any actor knows how to make an image live and put it out so that the audience sees it as being real, whether there's anything on the stage or not. And it's the same thing with magic. You transmute energy. You have an image, you create the image, and the image lives, and magic is performed.
Do you have any thoughts about the differences between individual or solitary magic on the one hand and group or circular magic on the other?
Personally, I like both. Magic and witchcraft are so individualized that it's really hard to make any sort of broad statement. I like to work alone, and on the Sabbaths, I like to work with groups of people. Part of my understanding is that part of the original witchcraft, whatever that might have been, was that it was a community event. People from the villages would get together, and they would celebrate the fall harvest, or they would celebrate the winter solstice, or they would celebrate in some ritualistic way the fact that the crops were good, the fact that the calves were being born. Whatever was going on in the community would be celebrated at specific times in the year, and it would be a coming together for the community.
We're on the verge of one of the Sabbaths now, being halfway between Walpurgisnacht and May Day and Halloween on the other hand. Without violating anyone's privacy or divulging any secrets, could you give us some idea of how you will be celebrating Eve of August or Lammas?
For me particularly, it will be a Thanksgiving. I have a lot to be thankful for right now, and what I will be doing is getting together with some people who I work with on and off.
Who will be a mixed group, all women?
This group will be all women. I work with both. I was trained by a man and worked in a mixed coven, which is still my real coven. The people who I'm most connected to are still the people that I train with, and we get together. We're in various parts of the state, so we don't get together very easily. We try to get together at least four times a year. The group that we'll be meeting on Lammas will be all women, and there'll probably be about six of us, and we'll probably meet in my living room because I don't have any furniture. So,
Will be a circle?
It will be a circle. My ideal would be to find a place outside, but it's so cold that I don't think that's going to be possible. If so, I'd like to go up to a park or the beach. If that would be possible, that would be nice. But probably it'll be in the living room. We'll do a circle. We'll have candles and incense and wine. And I don't know what the others are planning, but for me, I will give thanks.
Is there any particular goddess or goddess incarnation that you will be focusing your energy on?
No, there isn't. I tend to use the names that come to me as I need them. I rarely call on her by name because that also limits her. I call on her in ways that I know she can understand.
If my memory serves, in the 1978 invocation, you did read...
Oh, yes.
...quite a long litany. In fact, it was one of the most powerful things, a long list of the names by which we have called her.
Yes.
And just kind of really got a rhythm into it that seemed to focus the entire celebration right from the beginning. So you're not afraid of the names.
Oh, no. It's just that when I work on...
You like to use them all or none at all?
I like to use them all sort of interchangeably. I think when you talk about the goddess, you're not talking about a particular goddess. You're talking about the aspect of the goddess. And she has 1,000 names and 1,000 faces, and you can call any of those aspects into being when that's the particular aspect that you want to deal with. She comes as a maiden. You know, she comes very virginal and very innocent and very fresh. And she comes as the crone. She comes as the destroyer. And she comes in a gamut in between. And you can call on any of those aspects by any names. I say no, I don't stick to one name. I don't stick to one aspect. At each season of the year, I call on whoever at that point is closest to me.
By what name did Ariadne call her?
She would have called her Dictina or Britomartis. Those are the only two names of goddesses indigenous to Crete that I can find. Often, the goddess in Crete is not named at all. She's simply called the snake goddess or the great mother or the snake mother.
Other than enrolling at San Francisco State and taking your course this fall or attending your play, what could people who want to learn more about this do? Where could they go to read? What single book or set of books or place would you send them to? Or who should they go to?
Well, they should go to themselves first. There aren't any secrets. Anything that you want to know as far as where you stand spiritually in the universe, you can find out just by going to yourself. If you want to learn about the craft, you've got a choice. You've got all sorts of traditions to choose from and all sorts of books about them. Most of the books aren't any good. I can recommend Arthur's book, for sure. And there's another book by Stuart Farrar called What Witches Do that I can recommend, which talks about the Alexandrians. They are a modern group in England, and it talks basically about what your traditional mixed British witches' coven does.
What's the title of his book?
It's called What Witches Do.
By Stuart Farrar.
By Stuart Farrar.
And the other one was Arthur Evans' Witchcraft and the Gay Counterculture.
Yes. I can recommend to women Z. Budapest's Book of Lights and Shadows. I can recommend Paul Husson's Mastering Witchcraft, but I think a lot of it's unacceptable.
Okay. To someone who was totally unschooled in magic, but who wanted to look into themselves, say, on the night of July 31st, on the night of the Witch's Sabbath, what would be the best way that they could tune in to the energy of other witches around the world celebrating at the same time? What should they do? Where should they go? Should they be solitary or go with a close friend? For someone who was unschooled but just wanted to tap into it just for a taste, is that possible?
Sure. There are series of open rituals. I don't know of any for Lammas. They usually happen at Hallowmas and usually at the winter solstice, sometimes at summer solstice. I'd say that anyone who wants to learn and who's curious and who's interested should simply make a space in their room or their house where they're very comfortable, invite other people if they care to or work alone, take a bath, put on some scent that's pleasing to them, light a candle of a color that's pleasing to them, burn some incense that's pleasing to them, and sit with that. Maybe play a little music. Sit with that and listen. And if they're so inclined, make an offering of something, of anything. If they're working with other people, share food. It's always a very important point of the ritual to share food. It's bringing it back into the body. There's no division in witchcraft between body and spirit. We're all one unit. So if you work with other people, after you sit with your incense, your candles, or your music, that you could play it yourself. If you play an instrument, you could listen to it on K-San, or you could listen to it on your stereo. What is pleasing for you, what works for you, what brings you to a place where you can look into yourself, whatever works, do it. The idea is to create a quiet space where you can think about it, where you can allow whatever feelings happen to happen, and where you can, if you're with your friends, make it a little special by offering something to each other.
And with that, we hope that it's been pleasing for you to visit us here on The Gay Life this morning, Batya Podos. We hope that these conversations with Batya and with Arthur Evans, who was here earlier, have been pleasing to those listening this morning. And here on the eve of August, we say goodbye and blessed be to Batya Podos. Of a cause celeb in the lesbian and gay communities, the trial of police officer Daniel Marr and Kevin Guerin, a civilian, on battery charges in conjunction with the March incidents at Peg's Place, a lesbian bar in San Francisco, is being covered every day on KSAN News. The trial's being held at room 383 of San Francisco City Hall if you want to attend in person. The Gay Life on KSAN is co-produced by Fred Green and myself, Randy Alfred. And I also write a column, Taking Sides, in the Sentinel. In the current issue, which is just out, my topic is the mayor, district attorney, and sheriff of San Francisco. And the title of the column is Throw the Rascals Out, in the Sentinel, available in gay neighborhoods throughout San Francisco. If you're listening on Sunday morning, the show is repeated late Monday night at 1 a.m. That's early Tuesday morning, so let your friends know. This is KSAN San Francisco. See you in 2 weeks.